Master, Ashirin, the great Chinese master, went to visit Bangkok in the early part of the 20th century, and they invited him to give a Dhamma talk in the big temple there. And he got up on the Dhamma seat and sat in meditation, and everyone came to listen to him. He just kept on sitting on and on and on. They were waiting for a Dhamma talk at any moment, but he just kept on sitting. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, 1 hour. People starting to get a bit restless. 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours. 1 day, 2 days. 7 days later he gets up. And of course that's the best Dhamma teaching you can possibly give. You can't improve on that. And listen all around to the sounds in the cave now. It's so quiet you can hear your own brain humming. You hear the sizzling, scintillating sound. They call the sound of silence. You can hear that in the background, and that's the loudest thing going on. So our world is always striving and reaching after something. Trying to get something or trying to get rid of something. And the Buddha said, well, just how about not? They're not trying to get something, not trying to get rid of something. There's these very beautiful lines from the Kacchayana Sutta. Dvayani sitam kvayam vikave loko kacchayana loko yebhuyena titancha jevana titancha. This world, for the most part, it relies on the duality of existence and non-existence, is and is not, few and many, all these relative concepts, long and short, and dark and light, and big and small. And so these dualities, in a sense, make up our world, they make up our experience. We can't have experience without it. You can't have consciousness without being conscious of something. And if you're conscious of something, you have to be aware of difference. You have to be conscious of difference. If everything's the same, there's no stimulus for awareness. But think about that. Think about what it would be like. For example, if you're a baby and you're conceived, but you're not conceived in the mother's womb, where you have the heartbeat and the movement and you can hear the voices and all of those kinds of things. But imagine that you're conceived in a bath in a laboratory somewhere, where you're sort of grown in a dish or a bowl of fluid, and you kind of grow in there and you've got all the nutriments. You're fed all the things that the mother's blood would supply you with. But you're sort of completely soundproof and completely still. You don't have any stimulus at all. It's completely dark. Everything's just at the one temperature, and then you just keep on growing like that. Imagine what that life would be like. It's kind of freaky, isn't it? And then you get old and you go through adolescence and you just stay there. Grow older. Eventually you die. It's all in that same bath. And so because you don't have any, isn't because there's no stimulus, that your mind would not develop at all. There'd be no development of awareness or wisdom or anything like that. And so it's the difference, the differentness of things, that's what stimulates us. That's why our culture is so intent on competition. We think competition is a great virtue, because competition is based on a sense of difference. I'm different to that other person, or I'm different from how I want to be. And when there's a difference, then there's an energy. There's something that propels us to move from one state to another. We try to move from being ignorant to being educated. So we go to the university and we work very hard to change ourselves. We want to move from being poor to being rich. So we get a job and we work very hard to overcome that job. We want to move from being lonely to being loved. And so we go and find someone we can be a partner with and raise a family with. And we put a lot of effort into that. So that perception of difference propels us, makes us want to do things, makes us want to move in some kind of direction, build something, change something, create something, shift something, all of which is what life consists of. And of course that's why life is never very peaceful, is it? Because all that moving, creating, shifting, changing is a never-ending activity. You just keep on doing it, you keep on, you know, making things, keep on changing things, keep on working on things, and then at the end of the day you turn around and you look around and that's all. So what's the point? And to me there was a great example of this was given by Laurence Olivier, who was regarded by many as the greatest actor of the 20th century, and somebody who was a classical Shakespearean actor who continued taking voice lessons and training himself in his use of his voice, even though he's regarded as the greatest actor in the world. But even until his 80s, he would still take voice lessons, still working on his craft, still trying to improve himself. And then he died, and he left a message for future generations in his for young people. And he said, you know, he's done so much work and so much effort and reached the pinnacle of his craft, widely hailed, famous, knighted. He's made into a sir, and not only a sir but a lord. By the end, it was a Lord Laurence Olivier. And his message to young people was, don't bother. That was what he wanted the world to remember him for. Don't bother. It's not worth it. Go and mess around. Play around, have fun, because it's just not worth it. That really, when I read that, really struck a resonance with me, because reminded me of my own experience when I was playing guitar. Because you know, like when you're practicing a craft or something like that, you know, when you first start, of course, it's very difficult, and you sort of get the getting the basics and so on, and you know, you have to work very hard. But, you know, you gradually start to see results and things start to improve. And, you know, after playing the guitar for many years and putting effort into, you know, improving my craft and trying to do it well. But, of course, there's always someone better, isn't there? There's always someone who can play better, or there's always some way of improving and so on. And, you know, that's why the light bulb joke for guitarists is, how many guitarists does it take to change a light bulb? 50. One to change it and 49 to say, oh God, I could have done that. So, it's guitar players for you. So, you can always get better. You can always improve. You can always move from here to being a better guitar player. But once you've sort of got reasonably good at it, then it's not that easy to get better, actually. And you actually have to practice, and I would practice until, you know, physically I had, you know, strained tendons and things like that. So even though playing for many years, but still had, get strained RSI and so on from practicing too much. It's very common in musicians. So, you know, you're really just sort of playing as much as the body will allow you to. And even so, you know, you gradually kind of very slowly improve, and you can think, well, if I keep on practicing, you know, 6 hours a day for the next 20 years, then I'll be a better guitar player. I'll be able to play some of the things that I can't play now. And you have to look at that and you think, what for? Yeah, playing guitar is nice. You know, being able to play songs is nice. Make myself happy and make other people happy sometimes, make them very unhappy at other times. But at the end of the day, you know, you go to the grave, and what do you put on the gravestone? You say, he played guitar good. So this is where you sort of flop between these two extremes that the Buddha always talked about, the ubho ante, Vohante anupagama majjhima paripada. Not going to the two extremes, the Blessed One, the Buddha discovered the middle way. And so these two extremes, the one extreme we want him to get, to have. And that kind of attitude is something which is fairly straightforward. I mean, it's not really that straightforward, but it's recognizable. We know that that's the way of the world, wanting to have more, wanting to be someone, wanting to be famous, wanting to be rich, wanting to possess things, wanting to be liked. This is the kind of the way of the world. And if we follow that way, then we measure ourselves according to that measure. We measure our worth according to our income, according to the size of the house that we have, according to how many hits we get when we Google our name, how many friends we have on Facebook. And we measure ourselves and we measure others. And so this is the way that the world is moving. And very soon we'll be constantly measuring each other. If you meet somebody, the first thing you'll do is ping them, see how many friends they're having on Facebook, and if they haven't got enough Facebook friends, they're not worth knowing. That's how we're going to be moving. That's how we're going to be thinking. We're quantifying our human relationships. And this is the way the world has gone, to try to turn everything qualitative into a quantity. And so we measure our time not by how good it is and how what sort of quality it has, but we measure it by how many dollars we get for it. And so we're a good person or a successful person if we spend our time where we in a way that we get many dollars for every hour. What a strange concept. One of the strangest concepts in the whole world. One of the strangest sayings in the English language is time is money. You just stop and think about that for a minute. Time is money. So I mean, on a kind of metaphysical level, it's kind of a curious thing if you take it seriously, that time is the same thing as money. But what it doesn't mean is that what it means is you can't waste time, because when you're wasting time, you're going to waste money. That's what it means. Something like that. Because how bizarre it is that we're measuring our time, which is in fact the only thing that we really have, and the only way we can actually evaluate the worth of time is by comparing it with an amount of money. And so that thing which is actually valuable, the time that we have on this earth, that very precious opportunity we have on this earth, that's the only thing we have. And we can only make that mean something if we compare it to money. Very, very curious way of thinking. So this is somehow this kind of need to have this atita, and to define ourselves in terms of quantity, in terms of stuff, and that kind of desire, you can see on one hand is a perfectly natural one. If we look in the animal realm, for example, animals also have desires. You know, they desire to eat, they desire to have sex, they desire to be safe and to be comfortable, and so on. So they have desires, but the desires that they have are fairly moderate. And the same with most humans. You see, most humans, their desires are very moderate. But then there's a small percentage of humans, which sort of, in most societies, is only the very, sort of very few at the top, but in our world is becoming much more dominant, where you can't, your desires are not moderate anymore. It's not enough just to have enough good food to eat to get through the day. It's not enough to just have a home that's secure and protected from the weather and protected from vermin and so on. It's not enough. Nothing's ever enough. It's not enough to just have clothes going to protect you against the weather. It's never enough. And so this immoderate desire, you know, the Buddha called visamalobha, unbalanced desire. This unbalanced desire, pushing, ever pushing more and more and more. And this was very beautifully summed up, some of the beautiful summaries of the Dhamma, which is in the end of the Ratthapala Sutta, and some of my favorite lines there. Unno loko, the world is and you say, oh no, the world is deficient. The world is lacking. It never has enough. The world is this tanha daso, a slave to craving. And Ratapala gave the example. He said, well, he was talking to a king, and he said, what would happen if to the king, you know, here you are, you're the king of the country, you're the richest man, the most powerful, you've got control over everything here. And what if somebody was to tell you that the next kingdom next door to yours was undefended and they'd lost their king and that you could invade it and take it over very easily? What would you do? He said, well, I'd take that over. And what if there was another kingdom in the other direction? What would you do with that? I said, I'd take that over as well. And what if you took over all the kingdoms in the land of India? You'd be looking to the further shore, looking across the oceans and trying to take them as well. So this is this insatiate nature of desire. It keeps on getting more, wanting more and more and more. And this kind of desire is especially triangulated. This is something that's very important. But we only want things if somebody else wants them. This may be excluding sort of basic human needs or basic animal needs, or food and so on. But for the most part, we only want something because we see somebody else wanting it. That's what gives its value. It comes into the range of our awareness. It's covetable. It's desirable. And the more people want it, the more that we want it. We think we want it just because it's just coming from inside ourselves, but actually it's not. It's always conditioned. It's always part of a social network that's making us want things. Of course, that's the whole purpose of the advertising industry, isn't it? To create desire. And one of the main tools that it uses is it says for advertising, when it advertises things, it says basically desirable people want this. That's one of the basic messages of the advertising industry. Desirable people want this. So this is one of the options that the world gives us, Atita, always wanting more. And we can sort of, you know, do that with a kind of a self-consciousness about it. I saw when I was in Sydney one time, I saw someone driving a Porsche, and on the bumper sticker on the Porsche was, "Who dies with most toys wins." Who dies with most toys wins. It's a beautiful summary of it, isn't it? So someone like that, then you kind of embrace it with an irony. I mean, obviously he knows that it's stupid, but it still doesn't stop him from driving a Porsche, you know? So that's one way of doing it. But then many of us, we get disillusioned, don't we? We realize that, geez, what a load of rubbish all this is. Got no interest in big houses, we've got no interest in fast cars, we've got no interest in all the stuff. And so we can recognize that this also very often leads to that other extreme, the natita, the depression, the sense of ennui. We were discussing the other night, ennui, existential angst. And so, you know, we can recognize this is where the whole kind of this whole subculture is based around this, the whole kind of emo, goth kind of subculture thing, you know. Just kind of everybody just wear black and pale faced, and this whole kind of image of depression and despair and so on. And so this, and also very destructive activities. So this kind of natita, you know, destruction of things is always associated with self-destructive behavior, taking drugs and alcohol and so on. And this is something that also the advertising industry is very canny to, because the advertising industry, of course, they know all about psychology. And so they used to do, before it got banned, one of the kind of subliminal advertisings they used to do was they used to draw death skulls into cigarette smoke. So you couldn't see it, but it would be sort of a hidden death skull in the cigarette smoke or in the glass of whiskey that someone was holding. So the kind of the positive image that your conscious mind sees is, you know, really a handsome guy, you know, smoking healthy and so on, smoking a cigarette. But the image to your subconscious is the image of death. So this kind of image is playing on both of these things. And so that's normally, for most humans, that's where these two desires, these two aspects of the mind live. Seeking after being or having or becoming is conscious in our mind, but it's inverse. The seeking destruction. This is it's usually unconscious for most people, relatively unconscious. We don't see it. We have self-destructive behavior, but we don't see it. We don't recognize it so much. So it's important to bring these things to light. So this is the essence of the Buddhist path, is the practice of awareness. So we look inside ourselves to know how are these things manifesting? Where is that sense of conceit that I have, where I'm trying to have more and trying to want more and trying to define myself in this kind of big way, trying to puff myself up, present myself to the world? So if we look into our own mind, we can always see these things there. But then it's also also important to make conscious this darker side, this destructive side. What are we trying to get rid of? What are we trying to escape from? What are we trying to avoid? So we're trying to get away from things, and the Buddha used the immortal simile of the dog tied to a post. Wants to get away from the post and just keeps running and running and running around the post. The more it runs around the post, the more it tightens itself and comes closer to the post and then gets harder and harder and harder to escape from it. That's life. So when the Buddha taught the escape from these things, the middle way, so this is what comes from understanding. From a sense of wisdom. And so that sense of wisdom can only be born from a reflective sense and a sense of awareness. What's our problem? Where are we going into these extremes? Because those extremes are there, they're in everybody. How do they manifest for us? It's something that only we can answer. So the middle way, the escape from these extremes is It's not a compromise. And that's something that's very important to understand. It's not a compromise. It's not a balancing act. It's not a juggling. So it's something which completely escapes from the worldly dichotomies. So what's called the eight worldly dhammas: gain, fame, pleasure, and pain. Gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and obscurity, and blame and criticism, blame and praise. And how many have I said now? I don't know. Praise and blame, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and obscurity. There you go, eight worldly dhammas. So the middle way completely escapes from that, from those eight worldly dhammas. So it's not a compromise between them. It's got nothing to do with this word anupagamma. Not going anywhere near these two extremes. And so it's a completely different way of living one's life. So that requires us to question all of our values. Requires us to question all of the things we're doing with our life, all of the way that we live, whatever we're doing. And to subject that to the scrutiny of the Dhamma. Is this for my own benefit? Is this for the benefit of others? Is this for the benefit of both? And so there's this understanding, this reflective quality around these two extremes. And it gives them like a container. And this is something we need to bring to every aspect, a kind of watchfulness. When you're meditating, sometimes we're meditating and we get very active and very agitated, our mind's very restless. So the meditative mind just sort of steps back and watches that. Okay. And then sometimes you get very dull and very sleepy. Mind going blank and just no energy. And then you step back and just watch that. Ah, okay. And so this meditative quality of reflection around everything, it gives it, even though you keep on doing the same things, maybe you keep on, life keeps on going the same from the outside, it doesn't look any different. But there's a meditative quality around those things, a reflective quality. It gives them a context. And so that context is the development of the mind and the Eightfold Path. So when practicing the Eightfold Path, of course, all the different factors of the Eightfold Path, reflecting the different aspects of life, the different areas in our life that we need to pay attention to, we need to develop, and we need to keep on purifying. And so we've got to pay attention to this, the specific things mentioned in the Eightfold Path. It's not just a sort of vague kind of thing of you know, being, trying to be a good person, but there's very specific things that the Buddha said are most essential to develop. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. These specific things that need to be looked at again and again and again every day to reflect on it. My right view, how did I try to purify my view? How did I try to purify my understanding? Through reflection, through discussion, through reading, through meditation, through insight into the seeing in nature, seeing impermanence, seeing causality around me. How did I contemplate right view? How did I improve my wisdom? Right intention, a practice of harmlessness, a practice of loving kindness. How did I try my best to do these things? Right speech. What was my speech like today? Was it meaningful? Did I actually help people with my speech? Very, very simple guidelines with speech. If it's going to help, then say it. If it's not, then shut up. Very simple. So is my speech just full of mindless gossip that's just annoying people? Remembering that this is a meditation monastery. So if I'm just blabbering away constantly, then I'm just annoying all the people around me. So do I know how to keep quiet? Do I know how to say what's meaningful when need be, and be quiet when I don't? Right action, and keeping the precepts and so on, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi. I won't go over all of them in detail, but these are things that need to be reflected. This is the middle way. And so that practice doesn't have a lot of things. There's a lot of extraordinary things which are completely just not there in the middle way. Doing rituals, for example, not there, it's not mentioned in the middle way. Doing ceremonies, not there. It doesn't say you have to be ordained. Doesn't say anything about that. Certainly doesn't say anything about gender or race or age or anything like that. Is it only for young people? No. Or can old people try to improve their speech and try to improve their motivations and so on? Well, of course they can. Doesn't matter how old you are, how young you are. So that's why this Eightfold Path, you get so used to it. You get to take it for granted. Now, when you keep on coming back to it, it's just so extraordinary that actually it can be so simple and so powerful. When you look at that, you think, well, is there anything missing? And you really can't think of anything that's missing. Is there anything superfluous? Could you take anything away and still have a complete spiritual path? And you think, well, no, I really couldn't. It's all in there. And when we develop that, there's the thing about the path is that the path is conditioned. And the path is the path to the unconditioned, but the path itself is conditioned. And so the path itself still partakes of those worldly dhammas. It still has the dualities to it. There's still right view and wrong view, right intention, wrong intention, right speech and wrong speech, right mindfulness and wrong mindfulness, right samadhi and wrong samadhi. All of these worldly dualities are still there while we're in the path. So we practice what as best we can, we practice all of the eight factors of the path. And the short-term outcome of that is that it's positive, it's good, makes us feel happy, makes our understanding grow, it makes our sense of anxiety decrease, gives us all kinds of benefits that we can see and understand here and now. So that's all good. But that's only temporary, that's only sort of provisional, it's only part of the journey, the beginning stages of the journey. And as we continue with the journey, those dichotomies, actually just the more and more one continues, the more they tend to sort of dissolve gradually. They're not so black and white. I mean, we're used to that way of thinking, aren't we? We realize that people with little wisdom see everything in terms of black and white, and the more wisdom we have, the more we're able to recognize shades of grey. And so that's seeing the interdependence of things, the interconnectedness of things. It's not black, there's not white, there's shades of grey. So more and more and more we continue, and it's just those shades of grey. So the outcome of that path arrives at the unconditioned, arrives at what's beyond the dichotomies, beyond good and evil, beyond existence and non-existence, beyond life and death, beyond happiness and sadness. So the only word you can use for that really is freedom. Freedom's probably the best translation of Nibbana. It's just freedom. And the interesting thing and the critical thing about freedom is that if you think about freedom in a particular context, it's always freedom from something. So you get free from prison, or you get free from anxiety, or free from debt, or something like that. So there's always a dualism involved. And yet the state of freedom itself isn't anything. There's somebody who's sick and then they get better. What does the betterness consist of? Well, you can point to various sort of physiological things, you know, their temperature's gone down and they've got more energy and so on. But that's not what the freedom is. Freedom is, you can't pin it down, it's not anything. When a prisoner gets released from jail, they're freed, but what are they actually? Well, they can be everything. Every prisoner who's released from jail is freed, but they're all quite different. They're different people, they do different things. So what is that freedom? Actually, it's not anything. And if you try to pin it down and define it, your mind just kind of slides off. So this is why Nibbana is something that's so hard to talk about. Your mind just slides off it. But we shouldn't be confused about it. We shouldn't doubt it. And we should know that just as there is, as long as there's a state of bondage and entrapment, then there's a freedom from that. So this is my little talk for you this evening on the two extremes and on Nibbana as freedom. So I offer this for your reflection and contemplation. And I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
What's wrong samadhi?
Wrong samadhi, well, it's an interesting one. It's not defined as such, but I would say that wrong in the suttas, I would say that wrong samadhi is, first thing is that wrong samadhi is not no samadhi. Right? It's still samadhi. I mean, wrong speech is not no. I mean, wrong speech can be no speech, but generally speaking, wrong speech or wrong view is not no view. Yeah, it's actually got a content to it. So, wrong samadhi. It is samadhi, but it's wrong. And why is it wrong? Well, I think it's wrong because it's samadhi with wrong view. And actually, that was the sutta which we were going to be chanting today, the first sutta in the Magga Sanyutta. It talks about how from right view arises right intention, from right intention arises right speech, and so on. So it's only if you've got right view that you're right, that your samadhi is right. And if you've got wrong view, your samadhi is wrong. So in practice, what that would mean would be, well, if I start with the wrong view, for example, if I start with the view that I am the eternal and greatest being in the universe, for example,
I mean, I'm just assuming that that's wrong. I mean, it might not be for all of you, but just it might be for me, it certainly would be. And then when you get into samadhi, you can imagine if you've got that kind of wrong idea, then it's just going to feed your conceit. Yeah? And then you think, wow, I really am. I'm a being of infinite bliss and light, and I am the majestic creator of the universe and so on. So this is where you get these satires on Brahma and the figures of the Hindu cosmology. So this is what I think would be wrong samadhi. And so it's wrong, not necessarily because wrong samadhi or something doesn't, wrong in that sense doesn't mean bad. It's a bit more subtle than that. It's wrong in the sense that it doesn't lead to nibbana, it doesn't lead to freedom. Whereas right samadhi does. So it doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. I mean, if you look, say, at the different kinds of wrong view, I mean, you might say, you know, for example, one kind of wrong view is eternalism, okay, the belief that I'm going to go and live forever in a heaven realm. You say, well, it's a wrong view. It's not a bad view. You know, it doesn't make people do bad things. Well, it might do, but it doesn't, not intrinsically from the view itself. So it's wrong. Something that's wrong doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. It's the same in science as well. You know, like from a scientific point of view, you might say, well, Newton was wrong, you know, because his findings have been surpassed by relativity and quantum theory and so on. It still doesn't mean it's bad. It still gets good enough to teach to school children.
How can you know if you use right or if you use wrong?
If you use wrong in the first place. Well, that's why the Buddha said there's two causes for the arising of right view. One is, which is like an internal and an external cause. So the internal cause is your own reflection and understanding, and the external cause is the voice of another. That's what it literally says, paradogo. So it means basically when you can discuss with people and listen to things, and so there's a kind of a moderating effect that comes from interaction with people, where your own views, you know, the extremities, the falsities and so on of your views get pointed out. So this is why discussing views and ideas is very important.
So many views around, how can you know?
Well, you just keep on juggling them, yeah? I mean, they're, ultimately you have to rely on your own innate sense of wisdom, that's all, you know, and you keep on testing it, keep on inquiring. Does that make sense? Does it line up with reason? Does it match the evidence? Does it lead to a good outcome? Yeah. But you can't ever have like an absolute knowledge of the truth until according to the Buddha's teaching, you can't have an absolute knowledge of truth until you get enlightened, and that's because that's the enlightenment itself is the ending of delusion, so you see very clearly. So until that time, our vision, our understanding is to one degree or another twisted and limited by delusion. So you can't trust it absolutely, but you can still trust it relatively. Okay, so let's finish my pain perspective.